식사한다. 식사.
Lovely. Good manners.
I think they're quite glad that you're here. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Off the Record, which is produced by the Actors' Centre. I'm Paul Clayton. I'm the chairman of the board of the Actors' Centre. And Off the Record is a very self-indulgent opportunity for me to have the luxury of chatting to people I have had the privilege of working with about how they like to work. The Actors' Centre is an organisation that supports and helps actors throughout the whole of their professional careers, particularly at the moment we focus on graduates emerging into what is a difficult climate. It's nearly 40 years old. In 2 years, we celebrate our 40th anniversary, and it's an organisation that is responsible for continuing the tradition we have in Britain of creating the best acting talent in the world. We're also very grateful to Really Useful Theatres, who give us this gorgeous room to stage these events. So thank you to Really Useful and all of the team who help make this such a brilliant day when we come here. At this point, I normally spend a little time introducing my guest, a few highlights of their career. I think today all I have to say is, ladies and gentlemen, Tracy Ullman.
That's my joke.
All right, I'm sorry. Well, you can tell some of mine later on. It's gorgeous to have you here.
It's gorgeous to be here.
I sort of start just to root us, to think, is there a moment that you can think back to that you think that was the beginning of the journey to where you are today? Was there a moment when you thought, I think that's what I want to do, that's going to make me very happy?
I certainly didn't want to act. I wanted to be a designer, and that's what I trained to be, a theatre designer. not for very long, but I did. And then I went to Stratford in the 50s to see, with my parents, I went to see a production of King Lear. And there was no curtain. It was this enormous enormous set, like a poppadom. It looked like an enormous kind of poppadom, with a great rock in the middle, which was everything. And the stage, it all just turned like that. And it opened my eyes suddenly to, I thought, that's the kind of designer I would like to be. And that's the kind of designer I can't be, because I don't have that imagination. And my brother, Geoffrey, who only ever wanted to be an actor, had gone to Central and was on his way, and I thought, I'll try it. And so it came upon me accidentally, as it were.
So you came from York?
Yeah.
Down to London, to Central?
I did.
And Central wasn't where it is now,
no,
is it?
No, it was in the Albert Hall.
In the Albert Hall. Mm.
And so you could cut lectures and things and go and see somebody having a sing, rehearsing. And, you know, remember that film, is it The Man Who Knew Too Much? James Stewart.
Yes,
they did it there. Well, we were absolutely... There was nobody at any lectures, because we were completely bewitched, waiting to see James Stewart come round.
Did you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And how was it then coming out of Central into the world? Did you feel ready? Because I suppose one of the debates...
When do any of us feel ready, Paul?
No, but I suppose one of the debates now is whether it's... Is it worth training?
For me, it was worth training, simply because I didn't know anything about projection or discipline of any kind. Dancing I love, but I didn't know anything about the kind of discipline of dancing or the way that you can use your ribs and your diaphragm and things like that. I knew nothing about that. In fact, I knew nothing about that. I come across every single play and I think, there's something else I didn't learn.
Is there one thing that you did learn that you still use today?
I learnt immense curiosity, which I... And I went straight from Central to the Old Vic to play Ophelia, for which I got terrible notices. And I stayed there from 1957 until 1962. But I've said this often, so it's boring, I know. But I never remember going back, for instance, to my dressing room. I used to stand at the side of the stage and watch absolutely everything and everybody. And I've always said to students and people who are going to, anybody who's going to, if you're going to go to a theatre and open in a theatre, go and see whatever is on at that theatre, regardless of what it is. Because you can learn, just by sitting there, you learn something about projection, and those are the kind of things that you know about projection, but when you actually come practically to go and go to a theatre and play something, you need to go and see somebody else doing it. So before I played Sally Bowles in Cabaret here, and before that, a friend of mine took me to see, to the Palace Theatre where it was going to be, and took me to see The Desert Song. Well, it's nothing like Cabaret, but, you know, I could see what worked and what didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you what didn't work. Somebody in the chorus, they were all meant to be very kind of brown and, you know, desert-beaten, weather-beaten.
Yeah.
And obviously, I was riveted because somebody in the chorus obviously got in too late and was startlingly white. So I spent the evening watching, absolutely glued to this man who was dead white in the chorus. Hopeless.
And when you got that job as Ophelia, you couldn't tell anybody about it, could you?
No, I wasn't allowed. I told my parents, but I wasn't allowed to tell anybody until it was announced.
Right. But at least they told you, because nowadays, of course, people don't get told when they go for auditions and things. They don't get told whether they've got it or not.
Well, this is my real bugbear. I have a daughter who is also an actress, and I am incensed about the fact that you are asked, if you're lucky, you're asked to go for an audition, or you're asked to do a piece against a white piece of sheet and send it in. What does that mean? Or, if you're lucky, you go and you see somebody and you do your piece. Tell me who lets you know afterwards how you've done, if you've got the part, or how you've done. I am incensed by it. And so many young actors say now, well, I never heard. I went up 3 weeks ago. I suppose I haven't got it. I mean, it doesn't take much to... Well, we've all got these things, phones. I don't have that thing, but I do have this thing.
Okay, all right, brilliant.
I don't do that.
Okay.
But, you know, it's very, very easy to write a letter. You could write a letter and sign it and get your PA, and you say afterwards, would you write a letter? And the letter can say, it was jolly nice meeting you, and I'm so sorry, we're not going to work together this time. That's all you have to say, but people need to be told.
It's manners,
or
isn't it?
It's good manners, yeah. Or they need to ring agents and tell an agent, and then the agent can tell you. But that, I mean, I bet you there's a whole lot of people here, and that has happened, that you go for something and then you never hear.
There's a lot of nodding heads going on now.
And a friend of mine recently went up for something, and he didn't hear, and then his best friend told him that he'd got it. I mean, that's not the way to hear, is it?
No.
I think it's really bad manners, and I think it's also unfair.
It is, actually, because it's just good to let people off the hook if they're not...
Or just give... You don't have to give reasons to say, I'm sorry, it didn't work out this time, or, or how absolutely wonderful you're employed for this job. But something, because it's so nerve-wracking anyway.
And that passion you have for subjects like that is one of the things that when people are, you know, get the chance to work with you, you are a very good company member, company leader. And does that come from having worked in companies like the Old Vic with John Neville and people? And
I expect it
and
does.
Stratford?
I expect it does. It's a bit I like best, is being part of a big company. I didn't want to do anything on my own. Because, you know, where's the fun? And where's the fun, and how do you get made up for it? How would you sit in your own dressing room without anybody else there getting ready for a show where you're probably not going to know anyone in the audience either? What's the point?
That sense of fun is really important to you, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. I don't want to work with anyone who hasn't got a sense of humour.
No.
I really don't. I have a few times. Absolutely no names, but I have, and it's grim. It's too grim. It's hard, the job. So you have to... When we did... we won't mention it because of where we are, but the Scottish play in Stratford, it was at the other place. This was a long time ago, in the 70s. And the other place at Stratford then, for anybody who doesn't remember, was a shed. It was just a shed with a corrugated iron roof. And there was one great big room where we all dressed. Actually, the three witches and I were in a kind of cupboard, mm-hmm. just off the room.
Okay.
But a tiny bit of privacy, not much. But
camaraderie?
No, that the other thing.
You've gone back to computer.
No, not that.
Okay.
I don't have one.
Okay, no, we've established. Okay.
The level of, what's that word when you laugh a lot? Of conviviality or whatever
it is.
All
right, we'll go for conviviality.
Well, we were like children. We were just like children. We behaved so badly. During the half. And then once we were, because we did it without an interval, once we were there was a tremendous kind of concentration, because we kind of got rid of the froth on the beer, do you know? We'd blown all that away, and we were able to concentrate. Except one night when Roger Rees broke his ankle, and he was playing Malcolm, and there were no understudies, so he was in a wheelchair. And at the very, very beginning, somebody used to get... We all used to sit around in a circle. Somebody used to go and help Griff Jones, who was Duncan, and kind of divine right. They used to help him up and walk him forward. And then Susie Dury, who was playing one of the witches, used to dribble and drag her leg. And as Mari Keane passed my stool where I was sitting, she said, "It's the Lord's production," she said. Bit of trouble. It's ridiculous telling that story when I said we used to concentrate so well, isn't it?
I know. I might return to that in a little while. But that was a brilliant... That was a really good season, because that also had Comedy of Errors and Much Ado About Nothing in the mid-70s as well, which were all great shows. But was Stratford enjoyable when you used to go up there for whole big, long seasons?
Hugely. Hugely. But, I mean, it was kind of... There were no kind of equity rules then about when you stopped rehearsing. So we used to finish rehearsal at a dress rehearsal at 3 o'clock in the morning. And then we'd go and sit by the Avon. It was very, very romantic and dangerous. I'm afraid.
And enjoyable?
Oh, hugely enjoyable. But you felt very... very insular there and cut off, which, of course, is wonderful. Unless, of course, you have another part of you who's living in London or something, or, you know, or bills to pay in London, or, mm-hmm. you know, that was tricky. But it was glorious.
You have a very special way of accepting a part, in that you don't read the script.
Can't read it now.
Well, but you always were not a person for picking up the script and reading it.
No, it's right.
How do you make the decision then as to whether you want to do something?
If it's a play I don't know, then I ask somebody, the director usually or something, to come and tell me the story. And now I have somebody read me a script, which is excellent. That I can now say, in actual fact, it's because I can't see. In actual fact, I've never wanted to read it. And it's been all my life like that. So, but, you know, if a director comes and tells you the story, you catch something don't you think? You catch something. You just know whether you want to hear the story or not, and that's after all what our job is: coming on and telling a story. And so if you hear something that's exciting, then why not do it?
And does the passion with which they tell you the story also influence you, that you think they're very keen to do this?
Well, if you think they're not very keen to do it, I'd say you shouldn't do it yourself, really. yes, I think it makes a difference if somebody is enthusiastic and says, oh, it's going to be terrific.
Sometimes
you'll be terrific in the part, it's going to be wonderful. Well, how could you say no?
They tell you that story and they miss out key details, though, don't they?
Oh, yes, I know exactly what you're saying. This is, we worked together on Mother Courage. Is that all we did together? Mm-hmm. Mother Courage?
Yeah, we spent a year, really.
We did Mother Courage. and Howard Davis, who directed it, came to tell me the story. Absolutely fine. So then we came to the first day, first reading, and I was absolutely incensed with him, because what he missed out was the fact that Mother Courage is in every single scene. He'd only kind of told me bits, the good bits. And he never, I was furious. And you behaved very, very badly.
Right, okay, well, that's me in my place then, isn't it?
Are you going to tell this story?
Are you going? Well, I'm happy
you
to
tell it.
Okay, well, I had great pleasure of playing a character called the Angry Soldier, who came on after about an hour and 20 minutes, because it's quite long, isn't it?
It's very, very long.
So just before the interval, I came on and I had a big row with Jude. And then in the second half, I used to make a return to come and buy a drink from her wagon. And there's a sense of fun about working with you that you can't help but catch. So on the last matinee afternoon, Paul Greenwood and I arrived at Mother Courage's cart to supposedly throw our coins down and buy a tot of drink. And on that particular afternoon, we slid a credit card across the table, to which you said, "That'll do nicely."
That'll do nicely, yes.
And then you laughed a lot, didn't you?
I don't remember that.
But then you got your revenge, didn't you?
I did, because I thought, one more performance to go. Just one more performance to go, I'll get them for that. So I put cider vinegar in the drink that he had to go like that. And then he got his revenge, because he choked on it and spat it straight in my face. It is true, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And when people, when we tell that, people don't really believe us. But the great thing, it was done with a great amount of, because that was hard work, that show, wasn't it?
It was very hard work, because John Napier had designed a set, which was the cart, was on a kind of
pulley and wire thing, yeah.
That, you know, push around, and it always stuck. It just broke down all the time. And I remember Zoe Wanamaker played my daughter. And I remember once, it was always breaking down. We were always having to stop the show, somebody come in, mend it. And then on one Tuesday, it suddenly broke, a wheel crashed after the very, very first song. We'd done one circle and the song, and the wheel crashed. And I can remember getting off and saying, ladies and gentlemen, I'm very sorry, we are the RSC, not the RAC, and we can't be fixed. And Zoe and I got into a car, it was cancelled, Zoe and I got into a car, and about here at the Aldwych, she said to me, so this is what the Aldwych looks like at 8:20 on a Tuesday evening.
I know, I remember we were all getting out early,
yes.
And there were crowds of furious audience members outside the stage door.
They were very, very cross. Well, rightly.
Yeah, because they couldn't see it, but it was hard work. But there were, after that, let me jump to seeing you. I remember I was at Chichester. You went to take on Cleopatra.
I did.
Which was
at National.
Pretty sensational at the time. And are you fond of snakes?
I like a nice snake. I'm frightened of worms, but okay. I'm fond of a snake.
So you auditioned these snakes, did you? Did these snakes get
auditioned? We did audition. Do you remember that? We did audition. Peter Hall wanted the sight of her dead in her chair with a live snake. That was quite good because I could see the front row sometimes would go, oh. But is this a story you want to hear? But after, yes, we did audition them, and we chose Garter Snake, who sloughed his, what's it called?
His skin.
Yeah. For the first night, I remember. Because I remember looking into the thing saying, good gracious, the design department's been at this snake. But it hadn't. It was just a wonderful, brilliant colour. And then after I died, I used to be carried right up that centre aisle at the Olivier and then would rush round in time for the curtain call. And there was one night when I died and Miranda Foster used to take the snake and put it into a sack on the back of the chair. And I just felt the snake go from my hand. And I didn't know anything else. What she had failed to do was try get it into the sack at the back. And what had done is come through my wig. So suddenly, and I still didn't know that, and ran round for the curtain call and walked on for the curtain call and the snake took the bow. And I lost my voice with fright.
It was quite that production with which was Anthony Hopkins as Anthony. You kept quite a lot of it, and the scenes between you two quite fluid, in that you didn't set them. Is that something you like to do? Do you like to have that?
Well,
freedom?
In that case, on that occasion, we did quite like it. I mean, Tony was very against it being set. I think it worked because there was a tremendous fluidity about it, and I never quite knew where he was going to come from, or he didn't quite know where I was going to come from. So you know, it put you on your mettle a lot, mm-hmm. which kept it very bright and alert.
You've had the chance to direct.
I did.
Being on the other side, how was it? Did you learn a lot about actors?
Or did you learn a lot about directors? I certainly did.
What did you learn about actors?
Well, I tell you what you learn about actors. An actor comes to you and says, we are all so transparent. I had actors come to me and say, do you know, I've been up half the night learning this. And you think, no, you haven't. Oh, no, you haven't. And it is a very, very strange thing.
Did you enjoy it?
Not much. No, I didn't enjoy it much. Because you can't get up and do... I did the first thing. Ken Branagh asked me to direct the Renaissance Company. And we did Much Ado with Ken and Sam Bond and a whole mass of marvellous people. I find it a bit solitary. And actors gang up against you if you're the director. I prefer being part of it all and not just the person saying, do this and this or try this and this. And then I did Look Back in Anger also with Ken and Emma Thompson. And I did The Boys from Syracuse at the Park, which was I adored. Except that there... Because there were other plays in the repertoire, it was the summer, and when you go in to do your technical, I remember at something like 5:15 in the morning, still doing the technical, and a heron flying over the park. It was wonderful. I thought, there aren't many places you could be doing this, really, and a heron is there, and you know, and it's daylight already.
You quite like getting notes right up to the first night.
And beyond.
Did you do that with your actors when you were directing?
No, because I tried to give Ken... When they went on tour, they all went on tour, Much Ado, and I went down to Brighton to see how they were getting on, give them a few notes, and Ken Branagh left in his costume at the end of the show.
To avoid you?
Well, yes, of course. And I remember saying to Sophie Thompson, what happened to that wonderful scene that you were doing with the apple? She said, well, my mother came and thought it was a bit naff.
So well, they were being directed by their mothers then, rather than
yes.
by... So what is it, why do you like getting those notes right up to and beyond? What is it that...
Because then it's work in progress, which I think... Isn't it rather dangerous to think that on the first night you've got it all together?
Yeah.
I think you should go on thinking until the last night. That, and I remember, actually, in Antony and Cleopatra, I remember once there being a line which I thought of hers, which I thought, I'm sure that line should get a laugh. I'm sure it should get a laugh. And we did 100 performances, and on the 100th, I got the laugh. Too late then, but still.
Work in progress.
Better than work in progress.
Yeah.
Because we hope that it gets better, don't we? We hope that... But the thing is that every single audience is different. And so you're taught something about it every time, and it is... I've said it so many times, it is as if an audience gets together in the interval. It gets together before the show, rather, and says, we're going to be that kind of audience. Because it takes on a persona, and sometimes the same kind of persona. And sometimes... Or is it us? I don't know. But it's always different.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember at Stratford, when we were doing Comedy of Errors, one afternoon, we were all a bit jaded. And I had happened to see a lady coming in a blue coat who was sitting in the second row. And so all joshing about and everything before the show, I said, let's do it for her. Let's just do it for her. And it'll give us a kind of incentive. Yes, she wasn't there in the second act.
Let's use that as
poor woman.
Let's use that as a cue to move out of the theatre and into TV and film and things like that. We do have this tradition, and I suppose it still exists, that our training in the UK is still mainly stage and theatre based for actors. So there is a feeling, I think, now.
Is it so much now?
I think it's still there reasonably. One of the things the Actors Centre does a lot of is people do a lot of screen workshops because they haven't had as much time in front of a camera as they've had in preparation for stage.
Right.
Although, of course, young actors now, of course, are much more likely to work in television when they start than in repertory.
Yeah.
But I suppose,
no reps, that's why.
Yeah. But even so, when you came out into the world and then you did some TV and films, The Third Secret, I think, was an early film. Hello. There was a Dick Francis thriller.
There was.
Did you feel in any way prepared for film and television?
Not at all prepared for films. No, not at all prepared, because I've said lots of times, because I went about a film and this person said to me, well, you'll never make a film, because he said your face is simply not right for the screen. And that was fine, because I didn't want to make a film. You can stuff your film. I didn't say that, of course. It was a good, very, very good film. But that wasn't my passion. My passion was the theatre. But then, having made a film, and made several films, then you can, in the same way as you stand at the side of the stage and watch a theatre actor, you can watch a film actor, and you see how little is done. And that's a great discipline. I mean, God, you can learn a lot from that. I mean, that thing of saying, well, you don't do anything, that's not quite true.
Yeah.
You know, it's not true, you don't do anything. You don't do it in the same way as you do the theatre. You know, the bit of acting you do for the theatre, if you're thinking of a cake, is a big piece like that. And then when you're acting for television, it's a piece like that. And when you're acting for film, it's a piece like that. You know, it's the same process, but it's the projection you do, but you still have to have exactly the thought in your head.
And of course, in those days, we also had when you starting in television, we had things like Play for Today, which were more of a play being put on television. This story of the wonderful piece you did with Norman Rodway, which the name's going to elude me now.
It was called Four in the Morning.
Four in the Morning, that's it. Was that more comfortable in that it was a play?
That was because he worked in Anthony.
I know who you mean, but anyway, it's going to elude me. But let's just call him Anthony.
So good, yes. But he worked in a kind of play process, and also it was entirely improvised.
Yeah.
The whole thing, there was no script.
Yeah, no.
But also live theatre, live television we used to do. Lots of live television. I did a whole series called Hilda Lessways, Arnold Bennett, and that was unbelievably frightening. Unbelievably frightening. And I, at the end of one of the series, George Cannon, played by Bill Squire, had to say to me, "Will you marry me, Hilda?" And I had to say, "I'll think about it, George. I'll think about it." And we finished live, and we were all, with relief, sitting, having a drink. And my pa phoned, who was very, very down to earth, a doctor, very down to earth indeed. He phoned and he said, "Oh, darling, we watched it, absolutely wonderful. But Mummy and I think you shouldn't marry him because the man's a cad," he said. I said, "Well, it's actually too late because I'm going to say yes next week. Can't take your advice."
I remember, I suppose, the first morning I met you and rehearsed with you, and in that row scene, Hanif Qureshi, who'd done the translation, had given me the somewhat appalling task of using the C word in that scene. And I remember saying that it was...
Cider.
But I remember saying, "That's fine, but I won't be able to say it on the press night because my mother will be in and she loves a fine romance." And that made you... That made you do exactly what you're doing now, and I know you were very kind to my mother when she did come to the press night. But fine romance, in television terms, sort of changed things, didn't it? Because put you on the television every week, and it was another word, sitcom world rather than television drama.
I think that's the most frightening job you can do.
Sitcom.
The most frightening.
Why?
Well, because... You don't get any... There's no lead-up to it. There are no previews. You just have to know that that's going to be funny that night.
Yeah.
It's agony.
So 1 week and then recording at the weekends on...
Yes. Meet on a Monday. Meet on a Tuesday morning. Read it. Set it. Know it on Wednesday. Rehearse Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Do it on Sunday. To a live audience. And you do the most stupid things. Stupid. I mean, I had to do such an easy thing. I had to take 3 glasses, in fact, and walk over and put them down here. On the actual recording, for some unknown reason, I lifted all 3 up with one hand. Why would you do that? Fear. So then, of course, they say, no, we have to go back and do this again. So then you do it again. And then of course, the audience break into applause because you get it right. So they have to cut that out because it makes everybody look an idiot.
Yeah. Do you have a bit of a reputation for falling over on first nights, don't you?
Yes, no, not on first nights.
Yeah.
Not first nights.
but just...
almost every play.
And also, before we just move on to one final thing, before we go and get some questions, you do have a reputation for appearing in plays that you're not actually in. Perhaps you might have appeared in Peter Pan and Les Mis that the audience wouldn't have expected you.
I'd forgotten Peter Pan.
Yeah.
But Les Mis, we were doing All's Well at the Gielgud. And the Countess in All's Well, in the second act, she has a scene at the very beginning, and then she has a scene at the very end. It's a long time to sit there in your dressing room. And so I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll organise that I've got a costume, and I'll run up the road, and I'll do the barricade scene in Les Mis. So I organised that I had a costume, and I'd finished doing the Countess. I raced up the road, I got ready for the barricades, and they said to me, just before we went on, they said, you take this stool in, and they said, during the scene, you'll hear a shot, and you're shot, but we come and get you, and you'll be led off. I said, okay. That was exactly how the conversation went. So, and I knew all the lines, because we do it all at home. So we came in, and I put the stool down, and I sang the barricades, and they went bang, and I went, and two people came in, and he said, you've just been caught in the arm, he said. So I had to go, And I was back in time for the end of As You Like... All's Well. As You Like It. You see, not even the right play. All's Well. It was very, very exciting, and I could say that I've been in Les Mis then.
That's very good. I suppose we have to very quickly talk about... just me, personally, because it's indulgent. I can talk about M and coming into this enormous... Bond franchise, and then just taking that role in a whole different direction. And we were all very sorry to say goodbye to you in Skyfall, although immensely pleased. I watched it the other day again on the plane. Immensely pleased when you popped up on a videotape Inspector.
I haven't seen that yet.
Okay.
But I did have a morning on the film.
Okay, it's very nice. It just reminds us of what, you know, before we settle down to Ralph Fiennes. But was it fun? Is it fun doing those big movies?
It's hugely fun. Well, you're very, very well looked after. They're very, very nice to everybody on them. And you work hard, but it's frightening, but exciting.
They got more and more adventurous with you, didn't they? Because you started off in your office telling Pierce Brosnan off, and then eventually you're running
around. I got
out
into the field, as they say.
Yeah, got in the field, running around, literally within fields.
Well, I was never away. I was only ever stuck in that office until we made one. I can't remember which it was, but we had to go to Stowe School, and they put me in a trailer called Innsbruck, and they said, you can never complain that you didn't go away. Stuck in an old trailer in the back of Stowe School. I said, it's not quite, but I did get to Panama.
Very exotic. Did you get a hat?
No.
Okay.
Didn't get the hat.
Is there anything on the to-do list?
You've got to go through the Panama Canal, you've got to pay by cash.
No, I didn't,
yes,
actually.
You
no.
Do. It's just a fact that I picked up while I was there.
And I am my partner's in here somewhere, so if you could just make a note of that, if ever we go through the Panama Canal, that your switch card
you have
won't
to have,
work.
Yes, yeah. Quite. That won't work.
Is there anything on the to-do list, on the bucket list, that you think... Because recently you did The Vote last summer, and the live broadcast of that on election night.
Yes, that was exciting.
Is there anything on the to-do list that you think I'm waiting for somebody to come and tell me?
Well, you know, you never know, do you? People say, what part do you want to play? Do you know that? Do you know what part you want to play?
No, because I think the one that's really, really good probably hasn't been written yet.
Quite. But you'll be asked to do it, that's all.
I'm hoping.
Just hope to be employed.
And if I'm not asked to do it, they probably won't tell me.
And you won't know anything about
it, so that's
all right.
It'll just come on the telly one night and I'll see it.
I know. But I don't know. I don't think we're the best judge of ourselves. And so it's got to... We just have to hope, don't we?
Wait and
see. Something will come up.
Brilliant.
That is exciting.
I'm going to ask for some questions now. Is that good?
Yeah, fine.
Harry, I think we've got running around with a microphone, doing a brilliant job. So this is that moment where we'll get a nice embarrassing pause when I say any questions. And right down at the front in the centre. So just to make you walk a long way, Harry, we'll take a question from down here.
Hello. What advice do you give to your daughter about being an actor now?
Well, I try not to give her any advice, really. I just... You've got to be positive and not mind when you don't get something. You've got to think, oh, well, that wasn't meant to be. That one wasn't meant to be. The next one will be all right, you know. But when we did The Vote together, playing mother and daughter, she was so calm. And I thought, gosh, I've learned a lesson, you know. I learned so much from her during that. She was like a rock. I was very jumpy. So that was a very nice way that happened, round that way. But I don't know what advice is best, really. I think you have to wait to be asked to give it, do you know? And just be encouraging.
Good.
Because it's hard.
It is. And she's quite determined.
Yes, she is, and she has a wonderful singing voice.
Yeah. Let's give her another question. We'll go to the second row and then we'll come back. We might even work a little bit further back. Harry there. Yeah, brilliant.
Hello.
Hello.
I want to know what the best prank you've ever pulled on another actor is.
We're talking pranks.
This is disgraceful.
Well, I'm going to have to say that about 8 months ago, the delightful Celia Imrie sat in that very chair.
She's nothing but trouble.
She mentioned something to do with unwrapping a soft porn film that she'd appeared in during a performance of The Sea.
Yes, that's true.
With Edward Bond, that you'd managed to locate a video of a rather disreputable movie, and she...
It's true.
Is that the best prank you've ever played? Why are pranks important? Are they good?
Oh, aren't they?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I mean, the long-lived prank is the thing with Tim Pigott Smith, which we did a performance on at the Old Vic for Dame Peg's 80th birthday. That we were all on stage doing certain things. And Tim Pigott Smith, you're much too young to remember, but he did a bit of, what was that thing called?
Jewel
in the Crown, where he played a man who had a wooden hand, and so this hand was in a black glove, you know. And he was playing Octavius Caesar in Antony and Cleopatra at the time, and I said to him, very, very foolishly, I said, there's something strangely kind of sexually exciting about that. And the very next night in Antony Cleopatra, he came walking down the centre of the Olly towards me with his hand like this. Well, you know, I don't even have to tell you, do I? And there it was, the dreaded black glove. And the black glove since then has passed between us. I don't know how many. It's been on stages all over the world. All over the world. In plays. In every play.
He gave it to he gave it to Kevin Spacey to give you in Newfoundland.
He stuffed it up my arse.
Yeah, thank you.
In the shipping news. Absolutely.
We wouldn't have thought that was something associated with Kevin at all.
No, he wouldn't. Or serious filming.
No.
So no, the audience doesn't know. That's all that matters. The audience doesn't know. It's all right to have a thing as long as you contain it, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's fine, and it's very exciting. not knowing when it's going to come.
Do you know where that glove is today?
It was with Tim on Broadway in the Madness of George III. What is it called?
King Charles III.
It was given by Miles Richardson to Tim. At least he said it was more of a gauntlet. So maybe Tim didn't notice.
You never know.
It wasn't,
but it's still an ongoing thing.
It's ongoing.
Okay, let's move out. In the centre, striped shirt, Harry. Good shirt to wear for being noticed.
Hello. Paul may remember, actually, in the National Youth Theatre, Daniel Craig was nicknamed Wendy. And I just wondered whether there were any nicknames on the Bond set.
What?
So Daniel Craig,
I'm completely deaf as well as blind.
Daniel did his first thing as a 17-year-old when he joined the youth theatre with me.
Yes.
He became affectionately known as Wendy Craig throughout his National Youth Theatre career. And the questioner wants to know if there were any nicknames on the Bond set for anybody.
No. Well, there might have been, and I didn't catch on. Maybe there was. I wish I'd known that he was nicknamed Wendy.
He's not going to thank me if you tell him.
No, but he's going to know soon.
He knows. I know he is, yes. It'll be an email of apology.
I don't remember that anybody had a nickname. How disappointing.
Well, let's go right to the back. Glasses, Harry, just to keep you fit and running about on that side of the auditorium, and we'll come over.
Hello there. Hi. I was mesmerised by your performance in The Wind. I was mesmerised by your performance in The Winter's Tale because it's such a dark play, but you brought this lightness and comedy to it. And there's an old adage saying there's comedy in drama and drama in comedy. And I wondered, what's your process to find the comedy in scripts, in dark scripts, or find the darkness in comedy scripts? I just wondered what your process is.
It is a very dark play and difficult. But, I mean, it is essential. I mean, Paulina is essentially quite a funny part, actually. She's bossy, but she is in a way is kind of quite light relief. I think it can be played that way. I chose to play it that way. Although I have seen it done very, very kind of darkly. I don't know, maybe it's to do with the director's really saying, isn't it, how you orchestrate a play or a film, that it has to have differences and it has to have lighter and darker scenes. And it's really, if you get that clue, then that's what you look for. I mean, it has to be there for them to say this in actual fact, you know. It's like a conductor in an orchestra. Faster, slower, quieter, louder. You know, it's orchestrating the thing. And now I'm just trying to think of the process of it, because it was very, very difficult rehearsing. Not unpleasantly difficult, but hard, because the play is such a kind of strange, dark play. And so by the nature of that, you know, I think that it then kind of throws up a kind of scale, you know. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. Can I ask you about, you obviously like to reconfigure your work during the performances, and I guess you're doing that all the way through rehearsal to try and find those light and shade moments. Would that be right?
What was that?
You've talked about reconsidering your work as you rehearse and in performance.
Yes.
So is that part of the process of...
Because sometimes it was like I said about Antony and Cleopatra. Your instinct for lines and things like that, the lines and the shape of a scene changes tremendously. And it changes, of course. It's like that thing, there's only so much work you can do before an audience comes in, because then the audience will tell you the rest of the work. They will fill in, you know, we can get something together, we can decide that this is a play, and then we do it, and then you find out what works and what doesn't work. And the audience will inform you of that. And I think probably that's most, I don't know how much, does it make any sense? So,
good, he's nodding. So I think that's...
It's a rather convoluted and muddled reply.
Anybody over this side? We've been over that side. Let's come over there, Harry, just to keep you moving round. A tartan shirt on this side, very good.
A tartan shirt.
A tartan shirt, so that we can see. You like a bit of tartan. Okay.
This year we've lost a lot of amazing entertainment legends, you know, Alan Rickman, and today we've found out about Ronnie Corbett. So sad. I wondered whether you had any amazing stories about either of those two actors, Alan Rickman or Ronnie Corbett, that you could share with us.
People, we're talking about people who we've lost this year, like Alan Rickman and Bowie and other actors we've lost. Are there any particular memories, stories that come to you about any of those people?
Alan has, God, something in me that shuts off about all that.
It is difficult, isn't it? Because
very.
And when it comes in quite a rush.
I know. Donald, I was very surprised when Donald Sinden died this year. He wasn't very well towards the end of his life, although he'd been so kind of startlingly robust and well all the time I'd known him and played opposite him and been at Stratford and things. And then he wrote a note not long before he died, which said, I must try and say this dispassionately. It said in the note, "I have of late, though wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth." Shocking.
There's always some Shakespeare, isn't there, that fits. There's always a piece of... And he was great fun, because you and Beatrice and Benedict, talk about you twinkling.
And in London Assurance.
Yes.
And in Much Ado, oh, God, I'll never forget. It was set at kind of British Raj. It was set at Stratford. And he and I were having a scene, not at the beginning, but quite like... nearly half an hour into the play, we were having a scene, and suddenly he walked forward as somebody walked into their seat, and he kind of pretended that he'd got a watch. He just went, he said, "Do you know the story already?"
I remember seeing that on an afternoon when I was at drama school and went to Stratford, and I just never... That was the thing that made me aghast, that Shakespeare was just so funny watching that production, and that it fitted perfectly into that glove, people coming on with their cricket bats after the match rather than coming back from war. And beautiful. Let's come down to the front, because somebody's had their hand up, and then we'll come up to you there, and then I think we might be heading towards time. Sir.
Ooh. Thank you. Hello, Judy.
Hi.
How much fun was it to be part of playing Shakespeare with John Barton, and what was it like to be directed by John Barton?
Playing Shakespeare, that series.
Yes.
What did you say? What was the...
How much fun was it to do? Yes.
And with John Barton as well, who was, of course, a great Shakespearean guru.
He certainly was. Well, I mean, I don't think it's in retrospect that I say those days at Stratford, when I first went to Stratford in 1962, you know, we were so spoilt, because we were taught by Trevor Nunn, Peter Hall, and John Barton, and we were so spoilt about actually learning how to speak Shakespeare, which anyway was my passion from being a little girl, having seen my brothers at school. I just thought, that's all I ever wanted, was to do Shakespeare. Once I decided that I wanted to be an actor, you know, it didn't occur to me ever that I would be in a play, because I was going to design one, but not be in it. But then to have the luxury of having John and Peter and Trevor all being able, I mean, so that you need, I mean, you need, the bones of speaking Shakespeare were laid down for you. So, in such a disciplined way, that it's something I can, you know, I can take anybody on one side and say to them, I'll teach you, if you want to know, I will teach you about the discipline of speaking Shakespeare and obeying the line endings and the half lines and where you can make a pause and where Shakespeare says you're allowed to make a pause if there's a half line and the half line doesn't... here I am, you see, I'm trying to teach you that. Sorry. But so that was... they were kind of golden days. They were completely golden days. And John, oh, he was so dear, John. And I remember on the first night of Twelfth Night at Stratford, he always used to direct with a great big glass of milk, and he used to direct by tipping his chair back onto its back legs. And I can remember once he had the glass of milk and he was watching, and then he suddenly wanted to give us a note. So he put the milk down, and for how he did it, I don't know, because the legs must, but the leg of the chair landed up in the milk. You thought, that's a really good trick if you could do that. It would be wonderful. And then on the very first night of Twelfth Night, and all the floor was slatted, wooden slats, and he was coming up on stage to give a note, and he tripped and threw the milk all over these boards and things. So Twelfth Night always had the remains of this kind of terrible, sodden, huge glass of milk. I think it was rather lucky for us. I saw him actually not very long ago, and he was still as enthusiastic and, you know, as excited and planning to do things and as ever.
Good.
I don't know whether he...
I just remember he gave the best party when you were in Stratford at that house he had. Before Christmas, he invited all the company to his party. And
yes.
That was probably the best party we had during the year.
And there was nobody like him for teaching you a sonnet. No one.
Yeah. Harry, let's go on the rampage. We said we'd go to the middle there and we'll come down there, and I think that's probably going to be time. In the centre with Saar there, waving your hand. Very good. Thank you.
Hello.
Hello.
When asked what was the best piece of advice she had ever received, Emma Thompson said, imagine there's a fire in the next room. I was wondering what was the best piece of advice you've ever received regarding acting?
The best piece of advice.
Best piece of advice. Emma Thompson evidently has got a predilection for burning rooms, unsurprisingly. So what's the best piece of advice you've ever received?
It's hard, isn't it? On my way home, I'll think, of course, that was the first best piece of advice I've ever received.
We'll tweet it. We'll tweet it out.
I don't do that.
No, but we can, you know, text me. Yeah, you can manage a text.
I can just do a text. The best piece of advice... Sorry to be... can I ask another? Can somebody ask another question?
And then we'll come back. We'll go there, and then we'll see if we can make that
our best
piece of advice.
Hello. Coming off the back of a question about advice, I want to ask a question on behalf of the younger generation in this room, because you've always been quite a strong voice on behalf of the younger actors in the industry today, and the fact that we have it harder than it used to be, and we're given so many obstacles. What word of wisdom can you give to the younger generation that want nothing more than to be in the world that you have?
I say this quite a lot, but the thing is, try, if you really, really want to do it, try not to be disheartened by all the shit that'll be thrown at you on the way. try to be positive about things. I know that's very hard and stupid to say, but try not to be disheartened. I'm back to this thing of nobody's encouraged these days. Nobody's told, yes, you have got the job, no, you haven't got the job, and things like that, as we were saying before. If it's what you want to do, just go in a beeline for it. If there is anything else you want, you're tempted by, then do that. See what I mean? You have to be terribly single-minded. And that's not very easy if you haven't got a job and you've no money coming in. But I think there's something about learning as much as you possibly can from as many people as you come into contact with. Find out as much as you possibly can. I don't know.
I think that's very good, and I also think that's a pretty hot piece of advice as well. In that you have to maintain that.
That single, well, yes, it's
easy. You talked about passion, and that's what it
means. Yes, I think that's terribly important. Because if there is a single doubt that there's something else you are either attracted to, then perhaps that's the thing you should do, and not this. And don't get disheartened. Because there are so many people who dampen things down and make the job harder than it should be. Again, back to the thing of you go to do something and you learn 2 pages or 3 pages or something and you do it the next day because you had very, very little notice to do it, and then you get no return for it. I don't understand that. I really don't understand it. When it is so easy to just have good manners and let somebody know. I think I would say, the bit of advice I would think I would say, I mean, my husband Michael Williams and I did Mr. and Mrs. Nobody, which was the Pooters. We did it at the Garrick a long time ago. And he said to me, oh, Jude, this is going to be such good fun. There are 4 of us in it. We're going to have a ball. He said, well, it turned out to be the most difficult thing in the world because Michael and I were the only 2 who spoke in it. And at one point, I wore 3 costumes, one on top of the other. And, it took our energies. It was a blister. I mean, it got roars of laughter. But we were absolutely wiped out. We were completely wiped out. There's always something in a play that you're not prepared for. I also did a play called A Pack of Lies with Michael about the Krogers and the spies. And we were in this little house, a little suburban house in Ruislip. And I thought, oh, I think I know how to play this part. Well, I tell you, it was the most difficult thing, because this was a very contained person, very contained and very, very ordinary housewife. And I found it very, very difficult, not to speak loud enough, but to project that person to an audience, and especially the person up there, sitting at the back of the gods. And I longed to come down the stairs and say, you know, my Lord of Burgundy, I thought. I want to say, I couldn't do that. All I had to say was, well, I hope they come round. I hope they come round tomorrow. You know, very kind of small, contained things. So there's always something in a play that's going to surprise you, and always something you don't know about. Never think you know it all. Never think you know it all.
Have you had a nice hour?
Yes, have you?
Immensely. I mean, I could sit here for quite a while, but then
We've got to go now.
I've had the pleasure before. I think it's interesting, you talked about Michael, which is very nice because he was always very kind to me and we'd go down the pub. There's one thing I was reading and furthermore yesterday, and that lovely comment from Trevor Nunn about to be a great actor, and to have greatness as an actor, you have to have great generosity and greatness of spirit. And I don't think there's anybody in this room now who wouldn't acknowledge that greatness of spirit is what makes us all love you. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you to Dame Judi Dench.